Hello and welcome back to another exciting episode of Behind the Scams. This one is important because Nick and Sue will cover the anatomy of a romance scam. Before a single dollar is ever requested, a trap is meticulously built. In this episode, our hosts deconstruct the psychological masterclass these criminals employ. You'll learn how they don't just find targets, they hunt for people in specific states of emotional transition, weaponizing moments of change. They'll break down the slow, patient process of building trust, transforming mundane conversations into powerful data mining operations. And finally, they'll reveal how scammers create a false reality so convincing it feels more real than life itself, custom building a soulmate persona designed to bypass every one of your defenses. This is part one, building the trap.
Welcome to Behind the Scams. I'm your host, Nick, and today we're doing something a little different. We're tackling a topic so vast, so insidious, that it needs more than just one episode. We're talking about romance scams. And this is part one of a special two-part series, Anatomy of a Romance Scam.
And I'm Sue, and I'm glad we're splitting this up, Nick, because when people hear romance scam, they usually jump straight to the end of the story, the money lost, the heartbreak. But the real story, the part that so many people miss, is how the trap gets built in the first place.
That's exactly right. Before a single dollar is ever asked for, there's a meticulous psychological process of entrapment. It's a masterclass in manipulation. And today, in part one, we are going to focus exclusively on that. We're going to break down how scammers find their targets, how they build trust, and how they create a reality that feels more real than anything the victim has ever known.
And I think that's so important because the first thing people say is, how could they be so stupid? Or they must have been desperate. And it's just not true.
It's not. Not at all. I've seen victims who are doctors, lawyers, CEOs, academics, highly intelligent, skeptical people. This isn't about intelligence. It's about understanding human psychology. The scammers understand it and they weaponize it.
They really do. And that's our goal today, right? To peel back those layers so that listeners can understand the how. How does a smart, cautious person end up in a situation that from the outside looks so obviously fake? So if it's not about intelligence, what are the specific emotional vulnerabilities they're looking for? Are they just targeting lonely people?
Let's make this concrete. We've been following the case of a woman we'll call Carol. She's a perfect example of why the intelligence argument is a fallacy. Carol is the opposite of the stereotype. She was a retired head librarian, incredibly well-read, sharp as a tack, a lifelong critical thinker.
Exactly, but she was in a state of transition. She was recently widowed after a long, happy marriage. Her kids were grown and had families of their own. Her life wasn't unhappy, but it had become very quiet. It's not desperation they hunt for. It's that quiet space. It's the void they aim to fill.
It's more nuanced than just loneliness, though that's a powerful factor. They are hunting for people in a state of transition. Someone recently divorced or widowed is a prime target, or someone whose kids have just left for college, or who has recently retired. These are moments in life where our identity is in flux and our routines are disrupted.
So it's less about a pre-existing weakness and more about a moment of change.
Precisely. Because if you can understand the architecture of the scam, you can see the building blocks being laid. You can see the foundation being laid. We're going to deconstruct the emotional and psychological framework that makes these scams so devastatingly effective. This episode is all about the setup.
Beyond life events, they're also profiling personalities from our social media footprints, aren't they?
Absolutely. They call it target analysis. They're looking for keywords in public posts, words like lonely, hopeful, spiritual. They're looking for high empathy indicators, people who are always supporting others, sharing charity fundraisers. These are seen as generous, trusting personalities.
And they're looking for oversharers, people who post every detail of their day, their emotional state. They're basically handing the scammer a user manual on how to manipulate them.
That's a perfect way to put it. The more you share publicly, the less work they have to do. They can mirror your life perfectly because you've already given them the blueprint. It's in those moments that the universal human need for connection, for validation, for a new purpose becomes incredibly acute. The scammer doesn't offer a relationship. They offer a solution to that transitional anxiety. They present themselves as the next chapter, a ready-made future. And that is an incredibly seductive offer when your own future suddenly feels uncertain.
In part two, we'll talk about the financial exploitation, the aftermath, and the long road to recovery. But you can't understand the collapse until you understand how the structure was built. So let's start at the very beginning, the first knock on the door.
So Sue, where do you think these things usually start? What's the common perception?
Well, dating apps, right? I mean, that's the obvious one. Tinder, Match.com, Hinge, somewhere people are explicitly looking for a connection.
And you're right, that is a huge vector, a massive one. But it is so much broader than that now. We're talking about Facebook, Instagram, a random friend request with someone who has a few mutual friends, a direct message on Twitter. It can be words with friends.
Wait, the Scrabble game?
Yeah, the Scrabble game. Or any online game with a cat function. And one of the biggest ones we're seeing now, LinkedIn.
Okay, that one surprises me. That's a professional networking site. You don't expect someone to be sliding into your DMs looking for love on LinkedIn.
Exactly, and that's precisely why it works. The target's guard is down. The initial contact is professional. I saw your profile. I'm impressed with your work in X industry. Perhaps we could connect. It's innocuous. It bypasses the immediate skepticism you'd have on a dating app. The scammer's goal is to enter through an unguarded door.
So they're exploiting the context of the platform.
Completely. On a dating app, you're on alert for red flags. On LinkedIn, you're in professional mode. On Facebook, it might be a comment on a post in a group you're in, a gardening group, a book club. It starts with a shared interest, something that establishes an immediate, albeit thin, layer of common ground.
Okay, so let's talk about the profile itself, because we've all seen the ones that are obviously fake. Bad grammar, one blurry photo.
Let's go back to Carol. Where did her scammer find her? Was she on dating apps?
Those are the amateurs. The professional operations, the ones we're talking about, have this down to a science. The photos are carefully chosen. They're usually stolen from the social media accounts of real, unsuspecting people. They look for someone who is attractive, but not model perfect. Someone who looks successful, trustworthy, a doctor, an architect, an engineer on an oil rig, a soldier deployed overseas. Not at all. In Carol's case, she wasn't even thinking about dating. He found her in a Facebook group for fans of classic literature, a place she considered an intellectual sanctuary, completely safe.
The unguarded door you mentioned earlier, there's the key. The profession serves a dual purpose. It conveys authority and respectability, and it provides a built-in excuse for why they can't meet in person, why communication might be spotty, and why they can't do a simple video call. The connection is bad on this oil rig, or we're not allowed cameras on this forward operating base. It's a perfect narrative shield.
Precisely. The initial contact wasn't a private message. It was a public comment on her insightful post about Tolstoy. It started with, "I really appreciated your perspective on Anna Karenina." It was a conversation about books in public for a full week before he even sent a friend request. It was the slowest, most patient infiltration imaginable.
And the rest of the profile? The bio, the interests?
It's the level of detail that's so convincing. They don't just say, "I'm an engineer." They seem to live it.
They do, because they're working from a script, a detailed character Bible. An operative playing an oil rig engineer will have a folder of specific stories to draw from. The time a storm knocked out communications, the close call with a piece of heavy machinery, the camaraderie with a fictional crewmate named Dave. they have photos stolen from a Rio engineer's social media that they can send, showing them in a hard hat on a rig. It's engineered to be appealing, but slightly vague. Widowed, often with one child, to create sympathy and a sense of family values. They list interests like cooking, traveling, reading, charity work. It's a wholesome, stable, emotionally available persona. They're basically creating a character that is designed to be the perfect partner on paper.
And the profile of Carol's scammer, David, I imagine it was perfectly constructed.
It was a masterpiece of deception. The photos, stolen from the Instagram of a Norwegian architect, showed a handsome, silver-haired man in his early 60s. The persona was a civil engineer working on a major dam project in a remote part of South America.
And it's not just soldiers and engineers. That archetype works well on a certain demographic, but they have a whole portfolio of characters, right?
A full cast. There's the international architect working on a huge project in Dubai. This explains wealth and distance. There's the surgeon with Doctors Without Borders in a war-torn country, which plays on nobility and creates communication blackouts. There's the art dealer traveling Europe, which sounds sophisticated and explains irregular hours. Each one is a carefully crafted narrative designed to be both aspirational and prohibitive. You want their life, and their life is the very reason you can't be with them yet.
And they have props for each character. The architect will send you photos of blueprints, just stock images from the internet. The surgeon will describe a difficult but life-saving operation. It's a full-on theatrical production. So even the spontaneous little stories about their day are pre-packaged. Almost always, it's a performance. They are seeding these details to build a mosaic of a real person, a real life. The goal is to make the persona so rich and detailed that the victim never thinks to question it. It feels too real to be fake.
So the initial contact is made. The profile looks good. What happens next? Does the conversation get romantic right away?
Absolutely not. That's another mistake people make. They think it's all, "Hey, beautiful, I'm falling for you," from day one. The opposite is true. The initial conversations are, well, they're boring.
Boring? That seems counterintuitive.
It's psychological genius. The conversation is slow. Normal. How was your day? What did you have for lunch? Any plans for the weekend? They're intentionally building a rapport that feels organic and non-threatening. It's the kind of conversation you'd have with a new friend or a potential date you're getting to know slowly. It lowers your defenses. If someone comes on too strong, your alarm bells go off. If they're slow, patient, and seem genuinely interested in the mundane details of your life, you start to feel comfortable.
And during these boring conversations, what are they really doing?
Data mining. They are learning everything about you. They ask about your family, your past relationships, your dreams, your fears, what you're looking for in a partner. Every answer you give is a piece of data that they will use to build their strategy. They're looking for your emotional vulnerabilities and your unmet needs.
And they're mirroring you. I've heard this term a lot.
Yes, this is critical. Mirroring is a classic rapport-building technique that they've perfected. You mentioned you love dogs. Suddenly, they had a beloved golden retriever that passed away last year. You say you value honesty above all else. They tell you a story about how a past partner betrayed them and how they could never be with someone who wasn't completely truthful. They are becoming your ideal match in real time, based on the information you are feeding them.
It's like talking to a version of yourself. It must feel like you found your soulmate.
That's the exact phrase victims use, over and over. I felt like I'd known him my whole life. We finished each other's sentences. It doesn't feel like a stranger online. It feels like destiny. And this whole phase, this initial contact and slow conversation, can last for weeks. There is no rush. Patience is their greatest weapon. So by the time the relationship actually starts to feel romantic, a deep foundation of trust and comfort has already been laid. The red flags are not just subtle, they're practically invisible because the scammer has custom built a persona that has no red flags for you specifically.
Okay, so that foundation is set. They've established contact. The profile seems legit. The conversations are comfortable. What's the next step? How do they ramp it up from just friendly to something that feels like a real deep relationship?
So beyond just mirroring hobbies, what kinds of stories are they telling to build this perfect persona? What are the big emotional hooks?
This next phase is what we call grooming and trust acceleration. The goal here is to move from a casual acquaintance to an indispensable part of the victim's daily life as quickly as possible. And it starts with a routine. There are a few pillars they always build on. First is the noble wound. This is usually the story of their deceased wife, who they love deeply. This isn't just a bid for sympathy. It proves they are capable of deep love and commitment. It frames them as a tragic romantic hero.
And the victim wants to be the one to heal that wound.
Precisely. The second pillar is quiet integrity. They'll tell stories about choosing the honorable path in a difficult situation, maybe involving business or family. This builds the idea that they are a person of strong moral character. And the third, which is crucial, is shared dreams. They'll talk about the simple things they long for: a quiet life, cooking dinner together, traveling to a specific place, maybe a place the victim mentioned wanting to go.
The good morning and good night texts. So they're not just creating a person you like, they're creating a future you desperately want to be a part of.
That's the entire goal. They're selling a dream. And by this point, the victim isn't just falling for a person, they're falling for a life they've always wanted, a life that finally seems within reach. Exactly. It sounds so simple, but it's incredibly powerful. You wake up and there's a message waiting for you. Good morning, my queen. I was dreaming of you. You go to bed and the last thing you see is a message. Sleep well. I'll be thinking of you until the moment I can talk to you again.
And this stage is where the future faking becomes really intense. It goes beyond vague promises. It bookends your day. It makes them the first and last person you think about.
It becomes incredibly specific. They'll ask the victim about their dream home, and then, a day later, send a link to a real estate listing that matches the description perfectly. I saw this and thought of us. They'll discuss what to name their future dog. They'll plan in detail the first vacation they'll take together. Each of these is a little anchor thrown into the future, making it feel concrete and inevitable. It's not a fantasy anymore. It's a plan.
Right. The let's move to WhatsApp, it's more private line, which probably feels safer and more real.
Exactly. And right around this time, they'll make another critical move: getting the conversation off the initial platform. It sounds innocent, but it's a huge strategic step. First, it isolates the victim further. Second, apps like WhatsApp are encrypted and outside the moderation of the dating site, making the scammer harder to track and report. And third, it signals a new level of seriousness in the relationship, making the victim feel chosen and special.
It creates a pattern of emotional dependency. Your brain's reward system literally starts to expect it. That little dopamine hit when you see their message. After a week or two of this, if you wake up and there isn't a message, you feel a pang of anxiety. Is everything okay? Did I do something wrong? They've conditioned you to need their presence. And the language they use, it's not just good morning, it's incredibly intense right from the start.
Oh, it's a masterclass in hyperbole. It's never I like you, it's I've never felt a connection like this in my entire life. It's not you're attractive, it's you are the most beautiful woman I have ever seen. This intensity serves a specific purpose. It's meant to fast track the relationship and short circuits the normal, slower pace of getting to know someone.
Real relationships have moments of awkwardness, uncertainty, and slow progression. By flooding the victim with overwhelming compliments and declarations of undying love within days or weeks, the scammer creates a state of euphoria. It feels like a Hollywood romance. This intensity makes the connection feel more profound and special than any real-world relationship could, making it much harder to walk away from.
People talk about love bombing in these scenarios. Is that what this is?
It's a more sophisticated version of it. Classic love bombing can sometimes feel overwhelming and inauthentic. Too many compliments, too many grand declarations too soon. What the skilled scammers do is more about consistency than intensity. It's not a flood, it's a constant, steady drip of affection, attention, and validation.
And this dependency is woven into the fabric of the victim's life. The scammer wants to be involved in every decision. They encourage it. What should I have for dinner? What do you think of this outfit? The victim starts consulting them on small, daily things. The scammer becomes a constant presence, an advisor, a confidant. This deepens the reliance and makes the thought of them disappearing even more terrifying.
It's a complete integration into their life. They're not just a romantic partner, they're a life partner, a best friend, all rolled into one before they've ever met. Much more real. During this phase, they also manufacture intimacy. They'll share a deeply personal, often tragic story. This creates a powerful sense of obligation and trust. The victim thinks, he's never told anyone this before. He trusts me. I'm special.
It's a false bond, but it feels completely real to the person on the receiving end.
It is the only reality they have in this context. And then comes the push for exclusivity. Very quickly, they'll say something like, I feel such a strong connection with you, I'm not interested in talking to anyone else. I'm deleting my dating profile today. I hope you'll consider doing the same.
Wow, that's a big move, and it happens fast.
It's a critical step. For the victim, it feels like a huge romantic gesture. He's so serious about me. But what the scammer is actually doing is isolating them. They're removing them from the open market, ensuring they're not talking to anyone else who might be legitimate, or even worse, who might recognize the scammer's script. It's the first step in building what I call the relationship bubble.
The relationship bubble. Describe what that is.
It's an insulated reality where the only sources of validation and information are the scammer and the victim. Inside this bubble, a shared history is being rapidly created. They have inside jokes, pet names for each other, plans for the future. They are building a future that feels completely tangible, even though it's all based on words on a screen.
But Sue, wouldn't someone start to question things? I mean, weeks or months go by and you still haven't even video chatted with this person. Wouldn't that be a huge red flag?
You would think so, but by this point, the trust has replaced the need for verification. The scammer has already seeded believable excuses. They've been consistent, affectionate, reliable. Every promise to text has been kept. Every good morning has arrived. Their behavior has been flawless. So when they say, honey, you know I'm dying to see you on video, but the military firewall here blocks it for security reasons, the victim believes them. Why wouldn't they? This person has given them no reason to doubt.
So their own consistency builds to trust that they then use to excuse the inconsistency.
Precisely. The emotional investment is now so high that the victim doesn't want to find a red flag. They've found their perfect person. Skepticism feels like a betrayal of this incredible connection they've built. They're not just in a relationship, they're protecting it. They're protecting this beautiful future that has been promised to them. And that is a powerful, powerful motivator. The trap isn't just set, the victim is now actively helping to maintain it.
This brings us to what is really the engine of the whole scam, the psychological manipulation. We've built the foundation of trust and routine. Now the scammer has to solidify their control and make the victim completely impervious to outside influence.
But what happens when the victim does get a flicker of doubt? Let's say a friend says something that sticks and the victim asks again, more forcefully, I really want to see you. Can we please just video chat for 2 minutes? How does the scammer handle that direct challenge?
This is a critical test for the scammer, and they have a playbook for it. The first tactic is to turn the doubt into an attack on their love. They'll feign being deeply hurt. After everything we've shared, how can you not trust me? It breaks my heart that you think I'm lying. This immediately puts the victim on the defensive. They feel guilty for having hurt this wonderful person and quickly back down.
This is where it gets really dark, isn't it? It moves beyond just sweet talk and into something more sinister. So they make the victim feel like the bad guy for even asking.
Instantly. If that doesn't work, they escalate to tactic 2, the manufactured mini crisis. just as the victim is pushing for the video call, the scammer will suddenly have an emergency. My love, I want to, but my daughter just fell and we're on the way to the hospital. Or, the connection on the rig just failed. We have a major problem I have to deal with. It creates a distraction, generates sympathy, and makes the victim's request seem petty and unimportant in comparison. It's an expert deflection that always shifts the focus away from their lie.
It does. One of the core mechanisms at play here is cognitive dissonance. This is the mental discomfort you feel when you hold two conflicting beliefs. In this case, belief A is, this person is my soulmate, the love of my life, and he adores me. And belief B is, my sister thinks his photo is fake and this might be a scam. And the brain can't hold both of those ideas at once without stress.
There's also the sunk cost fallacy at play, isn't there? The victim has poured weeks, months of their life, their emotions, their secrets into this. To admit it's a lie would be to admit all that time and energy was wasted.
It's a huge psychological barrier. It's easier to double down on the belief than to face the devastating loss of that investment. And the scammer knows this. They know the deeper the victim gets, the harder it is to pull them out.
Correct. So it has to resolve the conflict. And because the emotional investment in belief A is astronomical, it's much, much easier to dismiss belief B. The brain's logic becomes, this feeling of love is overwhelming and real. Therefore, my sister must be wrong. She's jealous, she doesn't understand our connection, she's being negative. The victim isn't just disagreeing with their sister. Their brain is actively rewriting reality to protect the emotional core. And they actively start to poison the well against friends and family.
They do it with surgical precision. The victim might mention, my sister is a little skeptical. The scammer will reply, I understand, she's just protective of you. It's a shame she can't see how happy I make you. Maybe she's a bit jealous. It's subtle, planting a seed of doubt that the family member's concern isn't born of love, but of envy. Over time, these little suggestions can drive a real wedge between the victim and their support system.
So when friends or family raise concerns, they're not seen as helping, they're seen as attacking the relationship.
It's a classic isolation tactic. Frame the outside world as a threat to your special bond, and the victim will retreat further and further into the bubble you've created for them.
Exactly. And the scammer anticipates this and uses it. They'll say things like, my love, people may not understand what we have. They might get jealous. It will be us against the world, but our love is strong enough. They're preemptively framing any external doubt as an attack, which further strengthens the relationship bubble.
And this leads to isolation, crippling isolation. The victim stops talking to friends and family about the relationship because they're tired of the arguments and the skeptical looks. This is a huge win for the scammer. The fewer outside voices the victim hears, the more dominant the scammer's voice becomes until it's the only one they trust.
You know, Sue, back when I was a special agent is a phrase I feel like is coming. You know it is. We used to see this exact pattern in cults and high control groups. The first step is always to sever outside ties, to create an information vacuum that only the leader can fill. The tactics are identical. Isolate, create an us versus them mentality, and become the sole source of truth.
That's terrifying. It really is. And modern technology makes this kind of isolation so much more intense than it would have been in the past. The scammer isn't just in their letters or their email. They're in their pocket.
That's a huge point. The relationship exists on a smartphone, a device that is with the victim 24/7. It's in their home, in their car, on their nightstand. This creates an unprecedented level of constant contact and intimacy. The relationship bubble isn't just a psychological space, it's a digital one. The scammer's voice through text is often the first thing they hear in the morning and the last thing they hear at night. And then they introduce another powerful tool, intermittent reinforcement. This is the same principle that makes slot machines in Vegas so addictive. You don't get a reward every time you pull the lever, you get it randomly.
How does that apply here? It also feels like the technology on the scammer's side is getting more sophisticated, making them harder to detect.
Once the relationship is established, the scammer will suddenly pull back. They'll get distant, make excuses, maybe even pick a small fight. The victim, who is now conditioned to the constant affection, goes into a panic. They start chasing, trying to fix things, desperate to get back the feeling of security and love.
And just when they're at their breaking point?
The scammer returns, full of love and apologies. "I'm so sorry, my love. Things are just so stressful here." The relief the victim feels is immense. That flood of dopamine is even more powerful than the steady drip was before. This cycle of panic and relief creates something called a trauma bond. The victim becomes chemically, emotionally addicted to the scammer.
It's so calculated. To hear it broken down like this, it's not romantic. It's a series of deliberate psychological attacks.
It's a playbook. And by this stage, the victim's fear of loss is overwhelming. The idea of losing this person, this future they've built in their mind, is more terrifying than any logical red flag. They are in so deep that they will defend the scammer against all evidence, against all reason, because the alternative, admitting it was all a lie, is psychologically unbearable. It's not a choice anymore. It's a state of emotional survival.
And this is why even professionals, therapists, law enforcement, they can fall for this too, because it bypasses the logical brain and goes straight for the heart.
Nobody's immune to their own emotional needs. The scammers are experts at finding those needs and becoming the perfect solution. So when you ask, why did they defend the scammer? It's because they weren't defending a scammer. In their mind, they were defending the most important relationship of their life.
Okay, Nick, everything we've talked about so far sounds incredibly personal and one-on-one. It feels like one very skilled, very patient manipulator targeting one person. But you mentioned earlier this is an operation. What does that actually mean?
This is maybe the hardest thing for victims to accept. The person they fell in love with doesn't exist. And in most cases, it isn't even one person. We're talking about organized criminal enterprises.
So like an office building full of people doing this?
Literally. In places like Nigeria, Ghana, and increasingly in Southeast Asian scam compounds, there are call center-like setups. You have teams of people working in shifts. One person's job might be to make the initial contact and filter potential targets. Once a target is hooked, they're handed off to a more experienced scammer who handles the grooming phase.
Wait a minute. You're saying the person you're talking to at 9 in the morning might be a different person than the one you're talking to at 9 at night?
That's absolutely possible. They use scripts. They have detailed notes on each victim in a CRM, a customer relationship management file. It'll have your kids' names, your dog's name, the story you told them about your childhood, your hopes for the future, so another scammer can pick up the conversation seamlessly. That's how they can be available to talk to you 24/7, across different time zones. It's not one tireless suitor, it's a shift chain.
That is chillingly corporate. It takes away all the humanity. You mentioned scripts and CRM files. This sounds like they have a literal scammer's Bible.
That's what it is, a business, a very profitable one. These teams share information, they refine their scripts based on what works. They test different photos, different backstories. The relationship you're in is a product that has been market tested and optimized for conversion. That's exactly what they're called. They're collections of documents, PDFs, sometimes even software that gets shared and sold in these criminal networks. They contain everything: character profiles, backstories, folders of stolen photos categorized by profession. They have lists of romantic poems, thousands of loving text messages for every occasion.
And they're doing this to dozens of people at once, so even the beautiful, seemingly personal messages are just copy and paste?
Dozens, sometimes hundreds. A single operative might be juggling 10 to 15 active conversations at any given time. This is why the language can sometimes feel a little generic, or why they might forget a small detail. But they're very skilled at covering their tracks. The Bible also includes scripts for overcoming objections. What to say when they ask for a video call? What to say when they say they have no money? It's a complete playbook for emotional manipulation.
It also explains the patience. An individual might get frustrated and give up. A business with a proven model is willing to play the long game. And what about the people working in these centers? You said some are in Southeast Asian compounds. What do we know about that?
Exactly. Their timeline is not emotional. It's financial. They will invest months, even years, in grooming a high-value target if they believe the payout will be significant. The emotional investment from their side is zero. It's a job. They come to work, they put on the character of the loving soldier or the lonely doctor, they work their shift, and then they go home. This is a really dark evolution of the crime. Many of the scammers in these compounds are victims of human trafficking themselves. They're lured from their home countries with promises of legitimate tech jobs, then have their passports taken and are forced to work running these romance scams under threat of violence. They're prisoners.
The asymmetry of it all is just staggering. One person is in a deeply meaningful relationship, and the other is filling out a spreadsheet. So the person on the other end of the line might be just as much a victim as the person they're targeting.
That's a perfect way to put it. And understanding this operational structure is crucial. It helps to depersonalize the experience during recovery. In a very different but very real way, yes, it complicates the picture immensely. It's not just a greedy criminal, it's a vast network of organized crime, human trafficking, and exploitation on multiple levels. The person typing those messages might be doing so to survive.
So all this, the initial contact, the grooming, the psychological warfare, the operational teams, it's all just the setup. It's the long, elaborate first act of the play.
This is all pre-production. The emotional investment is the capital they need to raise before the real show begins. Everything we've discussed today is about getting the victim to an absolute, unquestioning trust and emotional dependency. Because once they reach that point, the victim is primed. They're ready for the second phase. The reason this whole operation exists in the first place, the extraction of money. And that is where we will pick up in part two.
So to recap where we are at the end of part one, the trap is fully built. They've shared their deepest secrets, their dreams. They're probably making concrete plans for a future together, a wedding, a house.
It's built, it's locked, and the victim doesn't even know they're inside. They believe they are in a loving, committed relationship with their soulmate. They've been meticulously groomed over weeks or months. They've been isolated from friends and family. They're psychologically bonded to a person who doesn't exist. And their brain has been rewired to defend this relationship at all costs against any outside doubt. The emotional foundation is rock solid, and it has to be, because it's about to bear an incredible amount of weight.
Because this is the moment the scam pivots.
This is the turning point. All of this work, all this investment of time and resources from the criminals has been leading to this. Now the financial phase begins. A crisis will suddenly emerge, a problem that only money can solve. And the victim, who is now completely emotionally compromised, will be asked to help.
And that's what we're going to dissect in part two. The requests for money, how they escalate, the excuses, the fake documents, the coercion, and the devastating fallout when it all comes crashing down.
It's essential that you join us for that, because understanding the setup is only half the battle. Seeing how they systematically drain a person's savings, their retirement, everything they have, it's a vital part of seeing the full picture of this crime. The trap has been built. Next time, we watch it spring. Thank you for listening to this episode of Behind the Scam.
If anything we've discussed today has raised concerns for you or someone you know, please seek out resources. You can visit stampoutscams.org, scamtv.org, and our own website, behindthescams.org, for related stories, information, and support. Behind the Scams is part of the SOS Media Network. We'll see you next time for part two.
And that brings us to the end of part one of The Anatomy of a Romance Scam. What we've heard today from Nick and Sue is a chilling look at the architecture of deception. This isn't about a simple trick. It's a campaign of meticulous psychological entrapment. we've learned how scammers target not just loneliness, but specific emotional vulnerabilities that arise during life's transitions, offering a seductive, ready-made future to someone whose own path feels uncertain. Through patient data mining, mirroring, and future faking, they don't just create a persona. They build your perfect partner from the information you feed them. The result is a creation of the relationship bubble, an insulated reality where the scammer becomes the sole source of validation, trust, and truth, isolating the victim from anyone who might see the red flags. The emotional trap is now set, locked, and fortified. This was the setup. Join us next time for part two, where the trap springs, and we dissect the devastating financial phase of the scam. Thank you for listening to Behind the Scams.